You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello, this is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, February 27th, 2026. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. Bridget Petoskey, Rabble's 2025-26 Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellow, has been working on a series examining the growing use of the notwithstanding clause by federal and provincial governments, as we discussed in last week's episode. This week, she sat down with Ontario Federation of Labour President Laura Walton to talk about why strengthening worker solidarity is essential as governments increasingly invoke the notwithstanding clause. Here is Bridget Petoskey in conversation with Laura Walton. Take a listen.
In 2025, the government of Alberta invoked the notwithstanding clause, ending a strike forcing teachers back to work, and imposed a contract on them that 90% of teachers rejected. The government in Ontario also used the notwithstanding clause against education workers, which prohibited them from striking or negotiating wages any further. It also imposed a contract on them as well. To ask a very broad question, what kind of impact do these types of actions have on workers' rights in the long term?
Yeah, so I think, to my knowledge, when Doug Ford did it to us, it was the first of its kind, where somebody was using a notwithstanding clause to interfere with free collective bargaining. And I think it's like anything else, like once one person or one party or one government starts to do it, it kind of opens the door to being able to do it more and more and more to every single person. And, you know, at the time, I remember, like, when I even found out about it, I was like, well, this is like cheating. You know, like if you can go in and say, essentially what the notwithstanding clause says is, notwithstanding the fact we're going to interfere and violate your charter rights, we're still going to do what we want anyways. That's in essence what it does. And so I think it really demands that workers, it demands that communities, it demands that people in all the provinces and in Canada start to really pay attention to what this clause is, what it can be done, and what it can, how it can be used if in the wrong hands.
For people that don't have further knowledge on this, how is collective bargaining a constitutionally protected right?
Yeah, so collective bargaining is protected constitutionally. We have the right to association, and under that, you know, section, we have the right to do free collective bargaining. And this is a very longstanding, been tested many times. As a matter of fact, the Ontario government, Bill 124 with Doug Ford, Bill 115 under the Ontario Liberals, both of those bills, which also interfered with free collective bargaining, did not use the notwithstanding clause, mind you, but both of those interfered. One capped wages, one froze wages. Both of those were found to be unconstitutional by the courts because it interfered with that right to freedom of association to freely negotiate the collective agreement, which is why Doug Ford, with Bill 28, needed to bring in that notwithstanding clause, kind of like the nuclear option, because he knew that it would be interfering with the charter rights again. And what this would do was basically say, but we can do it anyways. And it required us having another way to fight back besides using the courts.
How are workers' rights integral to the overall health of a democracy?
Yeah. Well, like, workers are democracy, right? Democracy by nature means for the people, by the people. And workers are the people, whether you are actively working, not, you know, retired, a young worker coming into the workforce. Workers' rights are people's rights. And anytime that you have a government who is interfering with the charter rights in order to achieve their means, right? And we're not talking about, you know, this is... a catastrophic situation or this is, you know, something outside of the norm. We're talking about everyday collective bargaining, you know, and so that's really problematic. And I think, you know, workers should be, people in general should be watching this and saying, well, like, why do you have to use that nuclear option, as they call it, to achieve your means? You really shouldn't. And I think anytime that you see any sort of party or any sort of form of government interfere with what is protected by the charter, people should sit up and take notice and really be questioning, you know, why are we supporting these people?
Can you think of anything that strikes in the past have won workers in Canada that we all enjoy today?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Like, I think this is what, unfortunately, and I say this as, you know, the president of the Ontario Federation of Labour, we do a really poor job of sharing labour history. There isn't good curriculum, and I say that as an education worker, there isn't good curriculum for students around labour history. Everything that we have in Ontario and in Canada has been on the backs of workers fighting for this, whether they went to strike or whether they, you know, were able to achieve it at a bargaining table. Nobody gives you anything for free. So the fact that we have the 40-hour work week, the fact that we have maternity leave, that came out of CUPW, you know, pushing back the workers there. The fact that we have sick days, the fact that we have pensions, the fact that we have benefits, all of these things, even when I think about our folks in 2022 going on strike illegally, you know, they wanted to remove our sick days. They wanted to remove our wages, all of those things we achieved. And when you rise, there's an old adage of a rising tide lifts all boats. When workers fight for what they need, it has the impact of making it so that other workers in other sectors, other workers in other areas also have the ability to do the same, right? And I think that that's really important. And I really wish that we did a better job of celebrating those labor victories, teaching those labor victories, because I think there's a lot of people, my own kids included, you know, who think, oh, well, this is just a given. We work 40 hours a week. You know, there's things like weekends. We have health and safety. We have all of those things. No, none of those things happened without people fighting for them. And in some cases, dying for them. And I think, you know, that's something that people need to remember, but I think it's also our job at the Ontario Federation of Labour to bring those stories to life.
One thing I was going to ask is there a risk of these types of actions being used against workers in the private sector?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, when you think about it, unfortunately, because I'll give you an example, they didn't use a notwithstanding clause. They used a section of federal law. But flight attendants, just recently with Air Canada, I mean, that's private sector. Right. That we don't own Air Canada anymore. That is a private sector. And, you know, the private sector convinced the government to interfere within hours of people going on strike to use legislation to force them back. So, yeah, like as long as there's money involved, as long as the rich may not be able to have as much profits as they would have. Right. And that's kind of what collective bargaining is. Collective bargaining, if you think of it as a pie and you have management rights and profit, collective bargaining ensures that workers get their fair share of the pie. And so, of course, the owners, the bosses want that less amount of a pie to the workers. The workers want more of a pie. And so anytime that, you know, bosses can convince the government that it's in their interest that, you know, if we don't do this, the economy is going to be in trouble, the governments will use legislation to interfere, whether it's private sector, whether it's public sector. And that's problematic. And, you know, kudos to the flight attendants with QP, with Air Canada, for defying that legislation as well, because, you know, governments have to understand you cannot interfere with workers' free collective bargaining rights. And we're going to continue to push back on that.
I have a question of wanting to make a distinction. For the provincial government, Doug Ford used the notwithstanding clause to order the QP workers back to work. Why was the notwithstanding clause not used when the federal government ordered their flight attendants back?
Yeah, so a different set of legislation. So Air Canada has federal legislation that dictates employment law, whereas in Ontario, we have the Ontario, you know, Employment Standards Act. We have the Ontario Labor Relations Act. So it's different set of legislation, different set of employees. So they used a different section in their federal act, whereas Doug Ford required this because he knew what he was doing was already going to be constitutionally, you know, improper, for lack of a better word. And so you, this is kind of like the get out of jail free card, right? Like basically what your notwithstanding clause says is, notwithstanding everything is in the charter, this is the law. Basically saying, we know that we're going to violate the charter, but in this case, it's warranted. The test then would be, is it warranted?
Got it. When the notwithstanding clause is used to end strikes and impose contracts, what tools do workers have left to fight for better working conditions and better wages?
So I think, you know, kudos to my colleagues at QP, who we just said, we're going to do it anyways. And we went on an illegal strike and we pushed back that way. You know, that was a tool. I was in an interview recently where I said, as long as governments are going to use this notwithstanding clause and put it in their back pocket and kind of hold it over the heads of workers, workers now need to plan for not just if you need to go on strike to achieve a collective agreement, but what are you going to do if you get ordered back? And so it's incumbent on workers, organizations, communities to be constantly organizing and be aware of the issues that are in play here, and make sure you're organizing and prepared. You can go to the courts. Absolutely. It takes years to go through the courts. And I have said many times and quoted many times, courts and governments are never going to give workers what they need. Only worker power gives workers what they need. And so, you know, that's why I do what I do now, which is working with workers from different sectors, across sectors, to build that sort of power so that we are getting what workers need. Because when workers get what they need, communities get what they need. And that's really important to me.
Has your organization partnered with other labor organizations across the country to kind of build solidarity across labor movements? And if so, could you explain how?
Yeah, so we all belong to the Canadian Labor Congress, right? So that's, you know, the broader parent group. But there's also informal, like, you know, we constantly are talking with each other. We are also standing in solidarity with each other. Just recently, we met with the Minnesota AFL-CIO, right, to talk about how we could support what's going on down there with ICE and how we could learn from them. You know, there is constantly, and I wouldn't say that there's always formal organizations that are doing this work, but rather informal little tendrils that are going across. Justice for Workers, you know, there's lots of really good work that's happening out in our communities, and we engage with different communities in that way, because it's not just workers that get impacted by with notwithstanding clause. I mean, it was used in Quebec against women being able to wear the hijab. You know, this is another area where we need to be mindful of that, you know, that is completely wrong. So working with different communities like NCCM, making sure that we're connecting with them to make sure that we are providing and amplifying the issues and building that community support so that this doesn't continue to happen.
Is there a fear among unions that the use of the notwithstanding clause against workers in Ontario and Quebec could have a chilling effect on unions being willing to strike in the future?
I don't know if it's necessarily that the willingness to strike, but that our tactics need to be different, if that makes sense what I'm saying. I think, you know, there's this misconception that leaders decide when people go on strike. It's not. The workers decide when they go on strike, right? It requires, you know, I know Doug Ford kept trying to say that the union bosses, me, I was telling 55,000 people to go on strike, you know, illegally. I don't have that power. It was the workers who determined whether they were going to go on strike. So I think I wouldn't say that it's like we're not willing to strike because we're going to get ordered back to work, but rather I think it forces leadership to think about what do we need to do to build capacity within workers so that if this happens, we are prepared to take the next step.
What are those tactics?
Yeah, so listen, strike legally. I've been there, done that. I can tell you, you know, I was threatened with $500,000 to the union as a fine, and that every worker would lose 10% of their wages. They would fine them 10% of their wages for every day that they struck. I had 55,000 people plus out on an illegal strike. Not a single person was fined. The union was not fined. Nobody lost their job, and we ended up negotiating that they got paid for those days. So, you know, there are ways to do it, but the tactics are, you know, you have to build that organizing. You have to build that power within workers. You have to decentralize that power so that it's not sitting with one person, but rather all the workers understand what's at stake. All of the workers understand why it's important to do this, and they're ready to move in unison. There are far more of us as workers than there are people in power. And when we recognize that, we are really capable of doing anything.
How do you build public support for your case? Like, what is your messaging to the public?
I bring them along every step of the way. You know, my big thing, and it's funny because after I'm done here with you, I'm heading into a strategic planning session for the Ontario Federation of Labour. And my big thing is, are we meeting workers and community where they're at? You know, you can't sit in an office and do this work. It demands that we're out with workers, where workers are, where communities are, on the front lines with them and talking with them and listening to them. Right? It's not about coming into communities and telling them what they need, but rather listening to them and then figuring out how to support. And so those are, you know, some of the things that I'm really, really key in, is having those conversations, training up the next generation of workers and activists and advocates to go out and do this work as well. I think we're at a pivotal time in our province and in our country. And it's incumbent on us to do that kind of work.
What do these uses of the notwithstanding clause signal about the approaches of Danielle Smith and Doug Ford to organize labor?
You know, Doug Ford and Danielle Smith to an extent, but Doug Ford more so. It's funny because there were unions that endorsed Doug Ford who stood behind me. And I think the one message that I would say is that I think, you know, if Doug Ford was talking to Danielle Smith and you know, It's that even if you have an endorsement, if you attack us, we come together as a family, because labor is a family. And our goal in labor, whether you're private sector, public sector, trades, our goal is to ensure that workers have great working conditions with fair pay and safe workplaces, and that we are able to give back to our community. And every single union that I work with is doing that. And it's our goal is to actually enrich workers and communities, not enrich a few. And I think Daniel Smith and Doug Ford are using something that was written into being because we were trying to convince back in the day, they were trying to convince the provinces to sign on to the charter. And so that was the escape clause, right? The escape chute was, yeah, this is it, but you don't want to lose autonomy. We get that. So we're going to give you this little ticket called the notwithstanding clause. And I think the one thing that I would say is that you use it at your own peril. You use it at your own peril, and people will remember that you were the person who did this. And I think Doug Ford has learned. I mean, he used it in 2022 and he hasn't used it since.
What has the OFL and other labor organizations done, or what plans are there for the future for in case these types of uses of the clause get invoked again?
There's building up capacity. There's also some advocacy work happening in the federal sphere to say, like, listen, maybe this notwithstanding clause in the way that it was envisioned is not being used that way. So how do we put some safety measures on it being used? And I know that work is happening up at a federal level. I think it also starts with education. Like when the notwithstanding clause, you know, was leveled against us in 2022, most people didn't even know what it was. Right? Like it was like, what? And so I think there's some education that needs to be done, you know, civic education about, you know, yes, this is a federal piece in the charter, but it's being used provincially. This is how it's being used. And I think that education starts with our youth so that, you know, they're ready and they see it for what it is. But I think it's within the entire population needs to understand, because I don't think that the population ever intended one person or one party to have that kind of power.
Something that I want to add is that in doing research for this series, one thing I learned was that it had originally been supported by a left-wing premier, the notwithstanding clause, because he believed it would be helpful for labor rights, because he thought the court would be hostile to the rights of laborers and that the electorate would be more favorable to it. But there's been constantly throughout its use a difference in how it was imagined compared to how it's being put in practice. And I think we're only seeing that grow.
I think we're only seeing the start of it. And I think like that's a really good example of how people perceive things based on your belief system, right? If I, you know, as a left-wing premier, they thought that this is a positive thing, but put into the hands of a right-wing ring premier, they completely used it in a completely different fashion. And I don't think anyone has that kind of foresight when they're doing that. And that's why that work around what are some of the safeguards that need to be put in place are so important.
was Rabble's Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellow, Bridget Petaskey, in conversation with Ontario Federation of Labour President Laura Walton. Thanks so much for that, Bridget and Laura. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. Here to get us up to speed is Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Starting this week with national news. The NDP National Convention is 1 month away. The slate of five candidates is locked in. Rabble has issued a questionnaire to each of the five candidates, asking them directly for how they would lead the party and the country in the face of the climate crisis, growing income inequality, and threats from Donald Trump. Questions include asking for what part of Prime Minister Mark Carney's budget the candidates would undo if they were leader, how they would further Indigenous reconciliation, and under what conditions, if any, they would support a Liberal government if they were leader of the NDP. All five candidates have now provided their answers, and we have published all of them on our site. Visit Rabble.ca today and read what Avi Lewis, Heather McPherson, Rob Ashton, Tennille Johnston, and Tony McQuayle had to say. Staying with NDP news, in an op-ed on Rabble, James Adair argues that the NDP should restructure the party from the ground up in order to be successful in the future. The NDP was reduced to just 7 seats in the House of Commons at the last election, and lost official party status. The party lost voters to the Liberals and the Conservatives. Adair argues that the party is stuck in a philosophical debate over its identity, namely whether it should focus on its grassroots or focus on winning seats. According to Adair, the NDP needs to go beyond just being a party or a social movement, but instead becoming an entity that does both. For example, the NDP could become more directly involved on the issue of housing on the grassroots level instead of solely trying to shape policy around housing from elected office. In labor news, this year marks the 10-year anniversary since the implementation of the Phoenix Pay system by the federal government. The federal government launched Phoenix as a new way to manage the pay and benefits of its employees. The program was immediately plagued by bugs and errors, however, with some workers seeing their pay withheld for months while others were overpaid. 10 years later, and there is still over 200,000 unresolved errors created by Phoenix, and the government still has not replaced the program. Unions representing federal workers, like the Public Service Alliance of Canada, say that they had warned the government back then about the problems with Phoenix, but were ignored. They also say that the federal government's plan to cut 40,000 workers will make another problem like the one Phoenix created inevitable. Prior to launching Phoenix in 2016, the federal government cut 1,200 pay advisors. Also this week, around the world, there are Canadian companies who are escaping scrutiny due to a lack of federal oversight. In 2019, the Liberal government created the Canadian Ombudsperson for Responsible Enterprise. That office is responsible for receiving and investigating complaints made against Canadian companies that operate overseas. The Ombudsperson would investigate if a Canadian company had been accused of exploiting workers or creating unsafe work environments. In recent years, complaints have been filed against Canadian companies from countries like Pakistan, Namibia, and Mexico. All of these complaints have gone uninvestigated, however, because the office of the Ombudsperson has been vacant since 2025, when Masoud Hossein stepped down from the role. The current Liberal government under Mark Carney has yet to install a new Ombudsperson, leaving many accusations against Canadian companies to go uninvestigated. In provincial news this week, Alberta Premier Danielle Smith has said in a televised announcement that she will be holding a referendum on immigration on October 29th of this year. The referendum would ask Albertans a series of questions about the issue of immigration. Observers like David Kleinhage say, however, that many of these questions are designed to stir up anti-immigrant sentiment and to scapegoat them for problems that the province is facing. According to Smith, immigrants are to blame for the overcrowding and crisis in Alberta's emergency rooms. However, as David Kleinhage points out, it was her government that consistently underfunded public health care. There are fewer hospital beds in Alberta today than there were before the COVID-19 pandemic. As well, it is expected that Danielle Smith will announce that her government is facing significant deficits when she presents the provincial budget next week, something else she will also likely try to blame on immigrants. In the Rabble Book Lounge this week, Tom Sanborn reviews Pizza Before We Die, an eyewitness account in Gaza by Hassan Kanafani. Kanafani is a Gazan engineer who has been living in the Palestinian territory throughout the war that began on October 7, 2023. This book compiles stories of events he witnessed from 2024 to 2025 at the height of the genocide in Gaza. He explains how he witnessed the targeting of civilians and aid workers by the Israeli Defense Force, as well as the impacts that the Israeli blockade of food, water, and medical supplies had on those living in Gaza. This account is at times difficult to read due to the subject matter, but Sanborn explains that it is a crucial part of the narrative of this dark chapter of history. And finally, in environmental news, writer and activist David Suzuki is arguing that Canada should take an environmental approach to its renegotiation of the free trade agreement with the US and Mexico over a focus solely on the economy. The Canada-US-Mexico Free Trade Agreement is up for review later this year, and Suzuki says that agreements like this are often gifts towards large, environmentally polluting corporations. This free trade agreement pulls back many Canadian regulations on US companies, making the whole economic supply chain less sustainable for the climate. Suzuki writes, quote, "Canada and Mexico must urgently break the chain of deepened integration with the U.S., as the latter has proven to be driven by violence, openly hostile to regulation, dismissive of international norms, and indifferent to the deleterious cross-border consequences of its policies." End quote. And as always, you can read about the full version of all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. To help support our show, please visit rabble.ca/donate, subscribe to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and now join us over on our Patreon for special bonus content. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca. Thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. And thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and we'll talk to you next week. Thank you.